as is our custom, the person who does not have the questions, their prep is to just get drunk.
Yeah.
And I've not had a drink in quite a few months now. So, like, I've had, like, a bottle of cider and, like, half a glass of wine and I'm just gone.
Oh, we're snapsies. I'm having medicinal cider.
Okay, that's good.
Such snapsies.
So we'll both just spiral then.
Bristol roots, innit? Hi, I'm Sophie.
Hi, I'm Mark.
And this is You Know What I Like, where we sit down each month and flail about something we're unhealthily obsessed with. You know what I like? History! Oh, history! Wherefore art thou, history? History! 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 Oh, history! 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 You don't need me to explain to you what history is. Let's get on with the quiz!
Quiz, 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 quiz!
Quiz, quiz, quiz. That said, I will explain the rules of the quiz because there has to be some formality involved here.
Okay.
So, long-term listeners of the podcast will be well-versed in the quiz, but for any newbies who want to have a fun time, I have come up with a quiz for Mark. There are four rounds within this quiz, and there are a grand potential of 34 points in total. I will explain the point system for each round as we go on, but suffice to say, if you get a good number of points, I'm going to say 20 out of 34, then you win a prize, which I don't know if you've decided what the prize is for yourself yet, but you do. And if you don't do that, then you get a punishment? Is that how we're doing it?
See, so as long-term listeners will know, we usually do a forfeit for these kind of quizzes. But I had a job interview this week. I was very tired. I have not thought of anything. I'm going to be honest. I have not planned anything. I drank wine instead. Shall we just do it for the joy of quizzing?
I just feel like it's a bit mean to punish you when it's just supposed to be like a fun quiz.
See, like, I had the same reaction to you, whereas, like, I can't punish you with a forfeit after, like, you've already made this very nice quiz.
And also for anyone who is new to this show, these quizzes are never supposed to be a test of knowledge so that someone comes out on top. These quizzes are a fun way to learn more about a topic that one of us is passionate about in, like, an entertaining way that you can play along with at home. So I feel like if we go forward, if anyone would like to suggest forfeits or whatever at the end, once they've listened, do feel free to tweet us. But otherwise, I feel like we just crack on.
Yeah, Sophie, stop being so competitive. Gee.
We all know.
Ruined all of these quizzes in the past. Come on.
Okay, before we fully dive in, I'm going to add a small caveat disclaimer, if you will.
Okay.
I don't know if it's obvious by the sound of my voice, but I am not 100% well. I think I fact-checked everything, but also I've been in a haze for 2 weeks. So if I say a date wrong, if I mispronounce a name, I'm sorry, but we're lucky that this is happening, guys.
Yeah, like we had the caveat like in the Greek Myths episode, like, we are not professionals, we are just enthusiasts.
Yeah, I just want the caveat to be taken into account. Like, get off my tits, I'm ill.
Yes. Okay, noted, formally noted.
In which case, are you ready to start the quiz?
I have never been more ready for anything, including the job interview that I had 2 days ago.
Well, round one. Can you see where this is going?
Ooh.
I have two different scenarios for you. For each scenario, I'm going to set up a little piece of a historical background, and then I'm going to leave it to you to improvise what could possibly happen next in this situation. There are 10 points total for each scenario, which means there are 20 available points for the whole of round one.
Oh, wow.
For each of the scenarios, there are 5 points awarded for accuracy, and I'm willing to stretch what accuracy okay. is. And there are 5 points available for panache, if you just tell me a good tale.
Panache, panache, panache.
Panache, panache, panache. That's where it is actually all in.
Yeah, it always is.
We're in the reign of Charles II. Monarchy has been restored. Theatre is thriving. Life is relatively good comparatively to some other times. You are Captain Thomas Blood.
Great name.
Great name. Yes. Sounds like you should be in like a danger spy or something.
I mean, like, it sounds like a character in like a vampire novel where like someone would be like, that's not a real person's name.
But also like a steamy vampire novel.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Okay, well, Captain Thomas Blood has decided to steal the crown jewels from the Tower of London. What he's done is he's befriended the keeper of the jewels and he's got himself invited to dinner. What happens next?
What year is this?
Oh, well, I've told you, reign of Charles II. He tried to steal them in 1671.
So no cell phones.
No. I said the reign of Charles II, Mark.
I know. I'm stalling for time with jokes.
I can paint some pictures that will have absolutely nothing to do with the answer to this question, but I can just give you some world building. As I mentioned, theatre is thriving in contrast to the reign of Oliver Cromwell and the Puritan government. Instead, during the reign of Charles II, who was nicknamed the Merry Monarch, things got a bit looser. Theatre became a thing. Women were allowed to be on stage. He even had a mistress who was an actress. Shock horror. Are you ready to answer yet?
Yes, I'm ready. Okay.
Okay. Take it away.
So picture this, right? So you've got Thomas Blood. He's collected this team of people. Okay. One of them is very good at spears. One of them is very good at costumes. One of them is very unapproachable at first, but then when you get to know them, they're a good guy deep down. They all gather around in this meal. They've all got a part to play. One's the waiter, one's the doorman, one's another guard in the Tower of London. They all have a heist.
I love heist it already. Ensues.
The crown jewels get passed between them. They think that like the crown jewels are here, but really they're over here.
There is some upset.
Things go wrong, as they do. It's a heist.
Like a slapstick sort of routine.
Exactly. They recover. It. And at some point, there's some like improvisational comedy routine, because there always is in a heist. And then, right at the end, just when you think that like everything's gone wrong, we see them be captured, we see them be found out. And then, because it's the Tower of London and the Raven Master of the Tower of London is currently an amazing human being.
He is, yeah.
A raven flies in, swoops down with the crown jewels and drops them in Thomas Blood's hands. He wins. We no longer have the crown jewels.
Okay. So what actually happened is that Thomas ties up the keeper of the jewels, stuffs the jewels down his trousers, rides off on a horse. He's almost out of the gates when he is caught by a guard, but he is brought before Charles, who found him so amusing that he immediately forgave him. He was given a pension of £500 a year, an Irish estate, and was welcomed at the royal court. And due to this absolute turnaround of a response, some people believe the whole thing was a setup so that Charles could get the jewels and sell them for himself. Other people just think that this man was ridiculously charismatic.
Okay. That is a fantastic story. I love that.
I love it.
I really like that I can picture like a scene like unfolding where like he's brought before Charles II. Charles II gives this long speech about like, how dare you? I can't believe that you did this. And then like he just like mugs at the camera and shrugs like, what am I like? And then he's like, oh, I like you. I like you.
Okay, so in regards to grading,
mm-hmm.
on the accuracy front, there's a point awarded for the fact that your fictional people did actually get their hands on the crown jewels.
Mm-hmm.
And I am going to give you a point for the fact that they got away scot-free, because technically, although he did have to return the jewels, he did get away better off than before he began.
That's very kind of you. Thank you.
2 points for accuracy. In regards to panache, I liked that we had a heist team. I wondered if we were going like League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, X-Men team style.
Oh no, definitely more like Ocean's 11, definitely.
Well, I realised as it went on. Initially, yeah. When you said one person's good with a spear, I was like, oh, a spear, okay. You say. And then I realised we were going more traditional heist. But I enjoyed your riffing off of a genre. So there's an extra point. And the imagining the slapstick routine tickled me. So I'm going to give you 5 points in total for that answer.
Did I get a point for the raven?
Oh, actually, I'm going to give you an extra point for the raven.
I'm pandering with the raven.
But I did enjoy the inclusion of the raven.
Thank you.
Okay, are you ready for the slightly longer scenario two?
I am indeed.
Okay, so picture the scene. It's 11:20 and you're King Henry. Things are looking quite good for you. You've just won a major battle against Louis VI of France over in Normandy. Curled ringlets have just come into fashion and you're feeling pretty snazzy. But it is time you did return to England. So you climb on a boat and a bunch of your family climbs on a different boat called the rather enticing name, the White Ship. Imagine that it was white, that's all I can assume. What should happen though, but the White Ship bloody sinks, taking with it nearly everyone on board, including your one and only male heir, William. Bloody hell. What does Henry decide to do? His daughter, Matilda, has already done quite a bit in her life. She married the Holy Roman Emperor. She acted as regent in Italy. The Holy Roman Emperor then died and she was widowed. It's been a time. But also, there's his nephew, Stephen, who is one of the wealthiest men in England. What Henry decides is he's gonna make Matilda heir to the throne of England and Stephen heir to his lands in Normandy. Time passes. It's 11:35 and Henry dies. What happens next?
So I'm going to do what I did in the last answer and riff off something else.
Okay.
Off the most obvious thing that comes to mind.
Okay.
So Matilda, who is the heir to the throne,
yes,
she has always been a bright child, but she comes from a family that never really cared for her. But once she's made the heir and her father dies, she finds some solace in one of her tutors. But as she grows up, she then meets this horrible, horrible witch who likes to throw people around the kingdom.
Also, how old do you think Matilda is?
25.
Bearing in mind, I have told you that she's been married and widowed.
40?
It's just you. No. She's a young woman. It's just you were like, tutor.
Yeah, she has a tutor. She's still learning. She admits that she is not perfect, that she still has to learn how to rule a kingdom.
I love that you're on Matilda's side. Let's go.
Yes. But then Matilda, like, also realizes that she has some strange powers as well. That, like, she can just, like, stare at something and it might move. But also, Steve, at the same time, he doesn't know who his parents are. Like, he's been searching and searching and searching for his parents. He's run afoul of the mob.
Afoul, you say?
Afoul of the mob, yes. And they are hunting for him, and they are trying to take away his dukedom, I'm assuming some kind of dukedom. And he finds out that his mother is still alive. He then goes to England, he meets up with Matilda, but then the mob comes, tries to kill Steve for all of the afoulness that he has run afoul of. But then just at that time, Steve's mother comes in with not a gun, because we're in the 12th century.
35.
With a slingshot.
Apparently there's nothing in between slingshots and guns.
Hey, I don't make history. This is what happens. His long-lost mother fires the slingshot, takes down all the mob members. Matilda and Steve don't run off together because that would be weird.
That would be fucked up.
They co-rule, and then England and France are fine for the next 200 years until they both die when the mob comes back and his mother's not there anymore. The end.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
First of all, I would like to say that I loved every second of that.
That was a ripoff of both the book Matilda and Tekken 4.
I like that it was like witches swiftly moving into mobsters.
Yes. Can you tell that I was I'm taking from two different things at the same time?
See, the thing is, when it comes to accuracy, there's an inherent issue whereby you've got them getting on and being friends, uh-huh, which is the exact opposite. You see, I'm about to tell you about a time period that historians call the anarchy. What happens is, despite the fact that Henry made all of his nobles swear to support Matilda's right to the throne, they all are like, a woman in charge of a country? Are you insane? So what happens is they're like, yo, Stephen, why don't you be king? So Stephen claims the throne of England. The 18 years of conflict that follow are the anarchy. I have two anecdotes I would like to share from this time of Matilda being extra. One time, in 1141, Matilda was trapped in Devizes Town by Stephen's army. How she gets out of this shenanigan is she pretended to be dead by dressing up in grave clothes and being put in a coffin and carried out like a corpse. And then as soon as they were far enough away, she like hopped back up and was like, thanks guys, I'm off.
She is fantastic.
It was already great. And in the same year, she was trapped in Oxford on a snowy night and food was starting to get a little bit low. So she just like threw on a white cloak, hopped over the wall, blended in with the snow and like ran away. So just like, she's just kind of making an exit.
Blended in with the snow.
Yeah.
Nothing, I'm snow.
But essentially, this goes on for like 18 years. Eventually, they agreed on a peace treaty where it was like, Stephen can continue to be king, but Matilda's son will inherit the throne when Stephen dies because Stephen had no heirs. That son is Henry II, the first of the Plantagenets, who, as we all know, ruled England for a rather long time. So Matilda got the last laugh, even though she should have got the bloody throne. When it comes to scoring you...
Accuracy is a zero, surely.
I'm just thinking about all the elements.
All of the elements?
I will say there was a lot of conflict, and it was not an easy journey for either one of them to achieve their aims. So I might be generous and give you like a 1 for accuracy.
That is very generous for the mess that just came out of my mouth.
Now that I don't have the risk of having to do something terrible hanging over my head, I feel much more generous with my scoring.
Yes, that's fair.
When it comes to the journey I went on, I might give you full points for panache.
Fantastic.
Your end of round one score is 12 out of a possible 20 points.
That's pretty good, given that I didn't know anything.
Yeah, so you know, go you.
That's very generous.
Round two is called... What in the world? ... This round is, there are 5 questions, and there's a possibility of 5 points. They're kind of just random things I thought of. Some of them have multiple choice answers. Some of them do not.
How consistent?
Question number 1 is a multiple choice question. What was Werewolf? Option A, a person. Option B, a weapon. Option C, a biscuit.
So, strangely, there is a recurring villain in Excalibur, the comic, the X-Men comic, called the Werewolves. And they are shape-changing creatures, kind of made of like a liquid metal.
I would like to remind you that we are talking about our reality.
I do understand the distinction. I'm just thinking, is there a reason why they were named werewolves based on the real life thing?
A worthy question. I give no response.
I'm going to go with B, a weapon, because I feel like that is the thing that is closest to the werewolf characters.
You would be correct.
Woo!
If you would like to make a guess at what kind of weapon, there will be a bonus point up for grabs, but no pressure either way.
I'm gonna, so like again, like in the same theme of what inspired this naming of this character, is it some kind of something that involves a trick in some form?
No. Would you like the answer?
Yes.
It's the largest trebuchet ever made. Do you know what a trebuchet is?
There's a catapult, which is like a mechanism that, like, there's like a whole arm. But the trebuchet has the cloth, right, that like flings it more.
Yes, it was built during the siege of Stirling Castle by Edward I in 1304. Edward I, who is nicknamed the Hammer of the Scots because he hated the Scottish so much, but he was also a piece of shit to the Welsh as well. So like, you know, just generally a bit of a shite, to be honest with you. But did know how to build a cracker of a trebuchet. It was so large that it could fling missiles that weighed as much as 300 pounds. And the Scots were so scared that they did try and surrender before it was finished, but the little fucker wouldn't let them because he wanted to see what it could do, and he refused to accept their surrender and decimated their walls instead.
See, right, like, obviously he was a horrible human being.
Yeah, sure.
But I also want to see this trebuchet.
I know, right? You're like, oh, Eddie, you're a terrible human being. But also,
can you show me?
Pretty cool. And if you wanted to demonstrate it where there's like no human casualties, that would be
really cool. Yeah, that'd be great. That'd be fantastic.
Yeah. A point for you.
How long was it?
When disassembled, it would fill 30 wagons. in its parts.
That is many wagons.
It took, apparently, it took 5 master carpenters and 49 other labourers at least 3 months to complete it.
Like, that's like a super extra convoy that, like, you have to bring just for the trebuchet.
Yeah, if you Google Warwolf, they have done, like, scale model recreations of it, so you can, like, get a sense of how big it was.
Cool. Is there one that I can go and see right now, right this second?
Not right now, Mark. Also, you've had a bottle of some forms of alcohol, and I don't think you should drive to a trebuchet place.
Put me in the trebuchet. Put me in the trebuchet.
That's the forfeit.
Yeah. If I win, then I go in the trebuchet. If I lose, I go in the trebuchet.
Excellent. Okay, are you ready for question 2?
I am.
We changed time period and topics wildly in this section. So,
okay.
Question number 2 is not a multiple choice question. How did some medieval people use chickens to try and cure the plague?
So the first thing that jumps to mind is the chicken being rubbed on the face. Partly because that's funny. partly because I feel like animals being rubbed on things is a thing that people probably tried at some point. You know, like, why not just try and rub it on the face? See what happens?
Specifically the face? Or just like...
I think something to do with either the feathers or the eggs. And I'm going to say the feathers. So maybe they, like, plucked the chickens over the person who had the plague and then rubbed them with the feathers.
What they did is they would shave the chicken's arse and tie them onto the plague sores. The reasoning being, they were clever enough to be like, okay, something's wrong and the body's not liking it. The logic was that if you tied the chicken onto the plague sores, all of the badness that's inside the plague sores would transfer into the chicken, and then you just have a dead chicken rather than a dead you.
But why chickens?
Presumably because they were easy and available at hand and not too much of a catastrophe if they died. And, like, you don't want to, like, strap a pig onto your plague sword, do you?
I was going to say, like, it would never be, like, a tie a cow to this person. No. Like, that would never work.
Yeah. But it's interesting learning some, when you listen to some wacky ideas that people had for curing the plague, because it often comes from the fact that it's like, when someone's ill, they smell bad, therefore bad smells must be what causes you to be ill, therefore if you A, smell nice things instead, you won't get ill, or B, spend some time in some other bad smelling things and maybe it'll, like, cancel it out.
I feel like a lot of human history is like humans being ill. Humans seeing that the animals next to them aren't ill and being like, they're obviously doing something right, so let's try anything.
But when you were, like, plucking the chicken, stuff like that, I was like, yeah. I'm not going to give you a point, though.
Like, I should have stuck with the pressing the chicken on the face, to be honest.
Question 3 is a multiple choice question. During a naval battle between Brazil and Uruguay in 1865, a Uruguayan ship ran out of cannonballs. What did they use instead? Option A, cheese. Option B, seashells. Option C, cutlery.
So I'm trying to think what they would have the most readily available.
A logical way.
And I don't think that they would have the seashells available because, like, even though they were on the sea, I feel like they wouldn't have the access to seashells unless they had, like, someone on board who was, like, a really big fan of collecting seashells and they, like, annihilated his collection of seashells.
He weeps.
Yes. So I'm actually going to go with... I'm going to go with cutlery because I feel like that happens in Pirates of the Caribbean at some point.
Let this be a lesson to you. Pirates of the Caribbean is not real.
Ah.
It was cheese.
Kind of cheese is the first question.
I do not have that information readily to hand, but I'm going to assume a hard cheese.
But, like, balls of cheese, like tiny cubes of cheese and pineapple, well, like...
But you make cheese in, like, rounds, so presumably wheels of cheese.
Wheels of cheese, okay.
Because the thing about cannonballs is, like, yes, if you get hit directly by a cannonball, you're fucked. But also, the thing that cannonballs do is that they blast into the side of a ship, and then all of the wooden shrapnel gets fired everywhere and causes infected wounds, and then people die. A hunk of flying cheddar's gonna do pretty much the same thing, really.
Follow-up question.
Yes.
Why did they have so much cheese on their ship?
I am also not able to tell you how much cheese they did fire.
Like, is it like when a shop has like a big sale and they like technically had it like at that price for like 2 days? Did they fire like one round of cheese and were like, we fired cheese?
All these questions and more Google can help you with, but okay. Not me. Okay, you have another multiple choice question.
Okay.
If a Georgian dude came up to you and said the phrase, I need a wooden suit, what would they be asking for?
Sex.
Well, option A, a condom.
Okay.
Option B, a coffin. Option C, a hat.
So I feel like the obvious answer here, and like how you may have misled me with your multiple choice. Then I'm going to go with a coffin because I feel like it's like a formal occasion. It's commonly made of wood. I'm going to go with coffin. B.
You are correct.
Woo!
I put a condom down because that was Mr. S's guess.
Okay.
To which I did raise the point that it's literally the exact opposite.
Yes.
The final question in this round is not multiple choice, but I have 100% told you about this before.
Oh, so
you should know it.
On the podcast or in real life?
I don't know if I've mentioned it on the podcast, but I've definitely told you about it in real life.
Okay.
It's one of my favorite historical facts ever.
Oh, God.
What weird disease were a bunch of peasants struck down with in Alsace in 1518?
Ooh, I actually know this.
You do?
Because it was part of, like, I sent you, like, a picture of, like, a fake magazine that was, like, mocking, like, Vogue and everything with, like, a bunch of different things on it. They were struck down with a strange dancing disease where they wouldn't stop dancing.
It was a dancing plague!
Yeah. Which, yes. I still don't understand.
I mean, it's either mass hysteria or it's, like, to do with famine and this type of thing that grows in wheat during famine that makes you spasm and jerk uncontrollably. But,
okay.
Essentially, in 1518, a bunch of peasants started uncontrollably dancing and they couldn't stop. And rather than doing anything to help them, the nobles of the time were advised that actually it was because their blood was too hot and they needed to dance it out. So they rented a hall, they rented musicians, they held a dance, and then as the hysteria spread, there were just loads and loads of peasants dancing uncontrollably. Some people died.
Like, it's funny, but it's not funny at the same time.
People died.
That's why it's not funny.
But also, it is funny.
Exactly.
Because the doctors were just like, oh, they've just got really hot blood. And yeah. They just need to, like...
keep dancing.
Yeah, they were like, we just need to get them through it. So they were like, you know what these guys need? Can't dance without music, can you?
Play something with a good beat, you know?
Yeah,
like,
give
get
them
the
a good
rhythm
beat.
Going. Doctors of the past were really just making shit up as they went along, weren't they?
Like, there's logic to things.
Yes.
But it's not correct logic. But it is logic.
And, like, it's, like, a lot of, like, a modern lens of just, like, we have, like, all the science now that we can, like, look back and laugh at it. But, like, at the time, it's, like, we don't know what's happening, so we're trying really hard.
Yeah. Okay. Moving on to round three, called Sisters Are Doing It For Themselves. I'd like to acknowledge that women do not have to be warriors to be strong and worthy. However, throughout history, a lot of women's history has been undocumented. Therefore, these gals are some standouts who made some waves and kicked some ass. This round is all about kick-ass women from history.
Woohoo.
Within this round, there are three rounds.
What?
What's going to happen? Okay, I'm going to explain. There are three groups of three women. I'm going to tell you three things. You're going to match up which women did which things.
Okay, I'm following.
You get 1 point if you match one woman correctly, and you get 2 points if you match all the women correctly.
Okay.
Round one is sort of just like noble women from the British Isles. Your women are Black Agnes, Ethelflaed, and Mary of Guelders. So I'm going to tell you three things. One of these women held Dunbar Castle against English attackers for 19 weeks and taunted them as they threw things at the castle walls by dusting the broken castle walls with her handkerchief as she walked around them. And eventually they just got fed up and they went home. Another one of these women was fed up with Viking raiders coming over and attacking shit all the time. So what she did is she led some troops into battle against them, then lured the Vikings into the city of Chester's city walls, wherein a hidden army waited inside, which slaughtered them all. and another one of these women went to war against the English alongside her husband. He promptly had his head blown off by a cannonball, but she carried on with the battle, took Roxburgh Castle, then captured an extra 2 English castles just because she could.
Okay, so to summarise, the first one we have the guardian of the castle. The second one is the guardian from the Vikings. And the third one is the rampaging Scotswoman. Okay, so I'm going to say that Black Agnes was the Scottish rampaging woman because that name sounds quite Scottish.
I do need you to know that Dunbar Castle is also in Scotland. 2 of the women are Scottish.
Okay. I'm going to stick with my answer anyway, even though it's probably wrong because you gave me the extra help, but I'm going to go with my first answer. I'm going to say that Ethelflaed,
yes.
She was the Viking protecting person. And then the castle protector is the third one whose name I've forgotten.
Mary of Guelders. You have got 1 point.
Woohoo.
Because you correctly identified from the name, I'm assuming, Ethelflaed is Viking protector. Well, protector against Vikings.
Yes.
Slaughterer of Vikings.
Yes.
You got the Scottish ladies the other wrong way round. So Black Agnes is the one who held Dunbar Castle for 19 weeks, and Mary of Guelders is the one who was married to James, I want to say, the second of Scotland. Don't know if that's right.
I love Black Agnes so much.
I think she's fucking great. I think all of the women in this section
great. Of course.
Round 2 is specifically pirate themed.
Yeah.
But also specifically not the pirates I talked about in our pirate episode.
Boo.
Your 3 names are Ching Shi, Gronya, and Jeanne de Clisson. Situation number 1. When the monarch executed her husband, she sold all of her lands to raise money to buy 3 warships, then sought bloody revenge by destroying the monarch's ships, murdering their crews, but leaving just enough people alive to carry the tale back to them. Scenario number 2. This woman is a pirate queen who commanded over 300 ships, and she's often considered the most successful pirate in history. She also has a very rare accolade for a pirate. She died in bed surrounded by all her family at the grand old age of 69.
Good for her.
Good for her. She also did like many brutal things, but like, you know.
I'm conflicted.
Aren't we always with history?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's true.
The third scenario is about another pirate queen who, legend says, cut off all her hair after her father told her she couldn't join him on a voyage in case her long locks got caught in the ship's ropes. Baller move. And then she took part in many sea battles. She controlled a number of castles. She once broke up with her husband by yelling out of a castle window, "Richard Burke, I dismiss you."
I love all of them. Okay, so like I feel like the third one, the shave off all of her hair and break up with her husband by shouting out of a castle, is the last one you said, whose name I can't remember, the French sounding one.
Jeanne de Clisson.
That one.
Okay.
And I'm going to go with the pirate queen is the first name.
Ching Shi.
Yes. And then the killed her husband, went on a rampage is the second name.
Is Gronya.
Gronya, yes.
You have got 1 point.
Ah.
So you got Ching Shi correct. Ching Shi is commanded over 300 ships, most successful pirate in history. Yes, yes, yes. And then again, you got the other two the wrong way around. So it's Jeanne de Clisson who made the King of France's life a bloody misery. He died. She then continued to torment his successor, his child. She was just like, no fucks given. And then Gronya is like a nickname. Her anglicized name is Grace O'Malley. And she was an Irish pirate queen. Her whole family were like a seafaring family during the reign of Elizabeth I. And she actually met Elizabeth I in person to petition about this guy who was being a dickhead.
Why are there not more movies about these people?
There should be.
There really should be. I want to see a film about Ching Shi.
I mean, there potentially is one. I don't know.
I want it.
Kick-ass pirates, the lot of them. And then the final 3, these are all women of the ancient world. Your names are Zenobia, Artemisia, and Mavia.
Fantastic names.
Okay, so scenario number 1. This kick-ass lady was a vital strategist during the Persian War and fought on the side of the Persians and personally commanded a fleet of ships during many battles, including the famous Battle of Salamis. When she realized that their side were facing defeat and the enemy had blocked the exit for her, she decided to ram her ship into one of her allies' ships, which sank it, but she was able to make her own escape. Scenario number two. This warrior queen ruled over nomadic tribes in southern Syria and led an uprising against the Romans. She rode at the head of her army, reached the frontiers of Egypt, all while repeatedly defeating the Roman army. She was so effective at defeating the Roman army that not only did they make a truce based entirely on her conditions, but they later called in her cavalry to help them out when the Goths attacked them.
See, I don't know about a group called the Goths. So, like, I just think of goth people.
That's not what the Goths are.
Attacked by the Goths. Oh, no!
They're like a Germanic tribe.
Okay.
They, like, sacked Rome at one point and stuff.
Okay.
It was a big deal. The Romans are about to pop up again with the third anecdote, because it's the ancient world and they were dicks. This rebel Palmyrian queen rebelled against Roman rule by annexing the neighboring states until she ruled Syria and Anatolia. Even when the Roman Empire retaliated and laid siege to Palmyra, she remained defiant, and according to Augustan history, she sent a letter to the guy in charge saying, "You demand my surrender as though you were not aware that Cleopatra preferred to die a queen rather than remain alive, no matter how high her rank."
She's so cool. Okay, so to sum up, we have the one who rammed ships into her allies' ship when facing defeat, the one who ruled the nomadic tribes in Syria and defeated the Romans, and the one who annexed the regions of Rome. So I'm going to say that Mavia is the one who rammed her ships into the allies' ship.
Okay.
That Artemisia was the one who annexed the regions of Rome and sent that amazing letter. And then the other one is the one who ruled the tribes.
Mavia.
No.
No, sorry, confused. Yes, Zenobia. I'm sorry to tell you that you got none of them right.
Ah.
But haven't we had fun?
I want to read about all of them.
I didn't know if you might know Artemisia, because in one of the horrendously bad 300 sequels, she's played by Eva Green.
I saw that film, but I couldn't tell you anything about that film.
I've never seen it.
It's very bland.
That's why I've never seen it.
Yep.
But I didn't know because of the Artemis aspect of her name, if you might connect that it was like related to Greece. So it's Artemisia who rammed the ship through the Battle of Salamis, because that was Persian War, which is Persians versus Greeks.
That's cool.
Mavia was the one who was really effective, and the Romans called on her cavalry later to help them out. And it was Zenobia who sent the amazing letter.
I love Zenobia. She's the best one.
Okay, final round. Round four is queer there and everywhere. I'm going to give you three historical figures. You're going to guess which one was not rumoured to be queer in some way. I'm also going to insert a disclaimer about the difficulties in applying modern labels to historical figures, and also the difficulties in ascertaining exactly what people's identities were. Sexual acts do not always marry up with sexual identities, etc, etc, etc. I've done my best to find people that we can be like, pretty sure this person's queer in some way, versus the odd one out who I'm like fairly certain seems to present as a heterosexual person. But, you know, disclaimer, disclaimer, disclaimer. I'm going to be generous, and I'll give you a point for each queer person you identify.
Okay.
Category number one is foreign dudes. So.
Okay.
Person number one is King Charles II of Spain. Person number two is Ludwig II of Bavaria. And person number three is Philippe, Duc d'Orléans, who is the brother of Louis XIV, son king, king of France.
Okay, can you give me a brief summary of each of them?
Charles II was king of Spain. He is a member of the Habsburgs, who were this essential, like, dynasty. You can usually identify the Habsburg because they have the Habsburg jaw, which is, like, this really noticeable jawline. That's about all I can tell you about Charles.
Okay.
Ludwig II of Bavaria has appeared on this podcast before. and I visited a castle. And I mentioned it in a segment on one of our episodes.
I think it's on one of our like anniversary episodes, if I remember correctly.
If anyone would like to listen to that segment, yes. And then Philippe, Duke of Orleans, was the brother of Louis XIV of France, who was the Sun King, who built Versailles, who was very, very famous, etc. Philippe was obviously not as comparably famous, but he was a very competent military strategist, as well as a courtier. He also was one of my favourite characters when I watched the TV show Versailles.
I feel like I'd want the military leader to be queer, and I want the person who did the castle. I'm going to go for those two because I don't want the jaw person. I don't want the Habsburg.
You are correct on both accounts.
Yeah.
Can I tell you more about each person now that that's out in the open?
Yes, go for it.
The reason why I chose Charles II of Spain as my heterosexual person is...
as my heterosexual person? It's a great phrase.
To be honest with you, it's kind of hard to know what Charles II of Spain's sexuality was, because he died quite young, because the Habsburg jaw that I have previously mentioned became increasingly prominent as the royal families increasingly inbred. And unfortunately for Charles, I genuinely have a lot of compassion for him as a human being, because he was born with a wide variety of genetic defects that were likely caused by the intense inbreeding. But also, and I don't want to laugh at him, but I do want to laugh at this quotation, and okay. I hope that that's clear enough. But a contemporary did describe him as always on the verge of death, but repeatedly baffling Christendom by continuing to live.
Good for him, I guess. Good
Which,
for him.
Bearing in mind I'm on my sixth cold of the winter season, I feel sometimes sums me up.
Yeah, yeah.
Ludwig II of Bavaria, and I did talk about this in our anniversary episode, was very much gay. He's so fascinating. He was king of Bavaria. He built all of these amazing castles that were inspired. They were like designed by prop makers and stuff rather than actual like architects. And he was just like super duper eccentric and just very interesting. Philippe, Duke of Orleans, was very open about his affairs with men, especially with the Chevalier de Lorraine, who was a long-term boyfriend of his. He did also marry twice and fathered children, and also throughout his life he dressed in, and I'm using air quotation marks, women's clothing, aka he wore dresses, but even at official royal events, which I find interesting given that Louis XIV's court was very defined by strict rules of etiquette and protocol. So I just find it very interesting that with a king who is very focused on controlling all the daily aspects of his subjects' lives, he had a brother who very much flouted convention. Round number two is Kings of England. Your people are Edward II of England, Henry I of England, and James I of England and 6th of Scotland.
There's a play that in one of the books I read on the Wars of the Roses where they mention a gay king. And there's a play about it, but I've not read it.
So you don't know which one it is?
I think it's Edward II. So I'm going to say I'm Edward II, because I feel like I added that play to a wish list somewhere. And I feel like James the Sixth. I feel like he is not, so I'm going to go with Henry I and Edward II.
Okay, you get 1 point.
Okay.
So, you got Edward II correct. Edward II, it is highly likely that he was lovers with his longtime favourite Piers Gaveston. He literally paid more attention to him than to his new wife at their wedding feast.
Okay. Sign number one.
People murdered Piers Gaveston because he was just too influential.
That's definitely the play that I read, yeah.
Yeah. Henry I... I would go so far as to describe him as aggressively heterosexual.
Okay.
He holds the record for the British monarch with the most number of children. He fathered 29 children, only 5 of which were legitimate heirs.
That's so many children.
He's the Henry from the beginning with Matilda and Stephen.
He's the son.
He's the Henry who died and then Matilda and Stephen squabbled over his throne.
Okay.
James I of England and Sixth of Scotland definitely had a fondness for beautiful men, had a lot of favourites who were very beautiful men and handed out lots of power and rewards to them. Most especially George Villiers, who he wrote many steamy letters to. I personally strongly dislike James because he was, among many things, extremely unhygienic and gross, but I do respect his right to take as many lovers as he likes.
How was he unhygienic?
Oh my God, Mark. He would go out riding, and if he needed to have a poo, he would just shit himself in the saddle and carry on going. As well as that, he would go hunting, and he would, like, if he sometimes, like, if he killed a deer, he would, and I'm sorry, like, trigger warning, gross animal stuff. He would, like, cut open the deer and get all up inside that deer.
Why?
And he never washed. He just delicately dabbed at a handkerchief every now and then. I just...
I'm still stuck on this guy himself.
I know! Just deliberately.
See, because, like, I can, like, admire the boldness of it, but it's also horrendously disgusting.
It's terrible.
Oh, that's funny.
So yeah, I really don't like him.
Okay.
Just so that we know. And not just for those reasons.
Yeah.
I just am not a big fan of James. Shall we move on?
I don't think that we can, Sophie.
I really should have ended with the shit faction.
You should have. See, like, poo jokes for me are like the height of comedy for me.
I'll
make
a note.
I am gone.
Our third and final category is noble ladies. We've got Berengaria of Navarre, we've got Queen Christina of Sweden, and we've got Princess Isabella of Parma.
I'm going to go Princess Isabella of Parma. Parma? Parma?
Parma, like the ham.
Okay, Parma. Parma ham. Okay. And I'm going to go with the second one as well.
Queen Christina of Sweden?
Yes.
You would be correct on both accounts.
Yeah, obviously.
Berengaria of Navarre was married to Richard the Lionheart. We have no evidence of her being queer, so I picked her as my heterosexual one. But also, she married Richard the Lionheart. She literally never set foot in England during her time as Queen of England. So, like, she just, like, chilled out and lived. Historians are not even sure if they consummated their marriage. For all we know, she might have been, but there's no evidence, so I've picked her for my heterosexual. Queen Christina of Sweden, again, I couldn't give you a description because all I know about her is the fact that she inherited the throne of Sweden. She dressed as, in quotations, a man, took part in a lot of masculine activities, refused to marry, ended up abdicating the throne, and it's also highly likely that she had affairs with women. Princess Isabella of Parma is my favourite anecdote of the three. She married Archduke Joseph of Austria, who was, quite frankly, thrilled to be married to her. He was super excited, and she literally locked herself away in her room so that she would not have to deal with him. And then embarked on an affair with his sister, and they wrote each other, like, 200 letters, which include the line, like, "I am told that the day begins with God. I, however, begin the day by thinking of the object of my love, for I think of her incessantly." So, congrats. You got 5 points for this round, which is... Would you like a grand total score?
Is that the last round?
That's the last round,
oh,
yes.
Can we just keep going?
Sophie furiously thinks of things.
Yes.
Oh, actually, my friend wanted me to include a bonus question that is entirely based on what she likes, but it involves me thinking of things on the spot.
It's worth 20 points.
Okay, so my friend... Hi, Anna, if you ever listen to this, is a massive Tudor enthusiast. She's doing a master's. Well, she's done a master's. She's written a whole book all about Tudor, fiction book. She absolutely loves Catherine Parr.
Mm-hmm. Same.
I'm going to give you 3 facts about Catherine Parr, and you're going to tell me which one is a lie.
I've seen 6, so I might know this. I'm really hoping that I know this.
Well, I'm entirely reading a message she sent me and ad-libbing. So, okay. Like, we'll see. First English woman to publish under her own name, is the model for Beatrice in Much Ado About Nothing, had a red velvet loo seat.
I really hope that the second one is true, because I really want to read Much Ado About Nothing, and I really like Catherine Parr, so I would love both of those to be true. See, like, I know that she did a lot of writing under her own name, because she wrote, like, a lot of psalms and everything, because it's in the song. Amen.
remember that I was a writer. I wrote books and psalms and meditations for female education, so all my women can independently study scripture.
Wait, is it Two Truths and a Lie?
It's Two Truths and a Lie, yes.
Okay, I'm going to say that the publishing under her own name is true, and Beatrice being based on her is true, because I really want it to happen.
Okay, publishing under her own name is correct. She was not the model for Beatrice from Much Ado, but she was the model for Kate from Taming of the Shrew.
I need to read Taming of the Shrew.
I haven't read Taming of the Shrew, but I have read Much Ado, and Beatrice is one of my favourite heroines, which is why I picked her when I panicked on the spot to come
I
up
see.
With something.
Okay.
And also, she did have a red velvet loo seat. I have been to her house and seen the loo. It's fab. And also... She wore black satin nightgowns, and I just feel like for someone who outwardly was very godly and pious, there's a little bit of delicious extravagance at the edges there.
Definitely, definitely. I do have a question about the red velvet loo seat.
Yes, yes, yes.
Bring you back to James I. Is that not very unhygienic?
Well, James I was an anomaly with shitting himself, to be fair. Most people were like, I need to go to the toilet, let's make a stop, rather than I shall shit in my saddle and carry on. I'm going to give you a point for getting the published under own name correct.
Okay.
And also because you love six, and that's
I
great.
Do love six.
Which your final total, you have 23 out of 34.
How many did I need?
You needed 20.
Ooh, I win.
So you're there. You won against yourself, and I don't know what you've won, if you've won anything.
It doesn't matter. I won. That's all that matters. I won.
Competitiveness coming out here.
I win.
Oh, bless your little heart. Right.
so condescending. Oh, bless. He's having fun, isn't he?
I would also like to know if anyone played along at home. For the answers where it requires you to make up an answer, you are more than welcome to tweet us with your answers, and I will give you scores for panache and accuracy. But please do not cheat.
And bonus points for like any ravens as well.
Throw a raven in, you get a point.
And for shitting yourself, like if that's part of it, then like I will give you bonus points.
Rather than just shitting yourself while listening to the episode, is that
yes,
what we're saying?
Yes, don't shit yourself while listening to the episode.
Bonus points if you were listening to this episode while riding a horse and you thought, hey, who needs to pull over?
I mean, like if you do that, I'm very impressed, and bonus points.
And that's the end of this episode of You Know What I Like. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher, and please leave a rating and a review. It helps other people find the show, and we'd love to be able to flail up more people.
We hope that you've enjoyed listening to us ramble, and please follow the podcast on Twitter at YKWILpodcast, or drop us an email at YKWILpodcast@gmail.com. Come back next month where we get overly excited about Crazy Rich Asians with Josh from Great Mates Podcast.
See you then!